welcome to this Touch podcast activity, which has been recorded for Touch Neurology. This podcast aims to bring you expert insights from a multidisciplinary team on recognizing the symptoms of Duchenne muscular dystrophy, key considerations for the diagnosis and pre-symptomatic screening for the condition, and emerging novel therapies for its medical management. Financial support for this medical educational activity has been provided to Touch IME by an educational grant from Sarepta Therapeutics. In this podcast, a paediatrician, a neurologist, and a patient advocate who is the parent of a patient with Duchenne muscular dystrophy discuss the traditional and non-traditional signs and symptoms of the condition.
Hello, my name is Dr. Laurel Kaufman, and I am a pediatrician at Weiss Bluth Pediatrics in Chicago, Illinois. I am joined today by Dr. Nancy Kuntz, professor of pediatrics and neurology at the Northwestern University Feinberg School of Medicine in Chicago. Welcome, Dr. Kuntz.
Hello.
And by Mr. Filippo Bucella, founder of Parent Project APS and an advocate for patients with Duchenne muscular dystrophy from Rome, Italy. Welcome, Mr. Bucella.
Hello.
In this section, we will be considering the question, what are the key signs and symptoms of Duchenne muscular dystrophy? Duchenne is a severe progressive muscle degenerating disease and the most common form of muscular dystrophy. In my clinical practice, I've only seen a handful of patients outside of residency. But for Dr. Kuntz, what is the prevalence of Duchenne muscular dystrophy? And what are the potential factors that may increase a child developing DMD?
Well, this is a disorder, a genetic disorder linked to the X chromosome. It's symptomatic primarily in boys. There are very rare carriers who are women with symptoms. But our discussion today is about the common form, which is really limited to boys and men. They estimate 1 in 3,500 live births in male infants may have a mutation in this dystrophin gene on the X chromosome. But one of the most complicated parts of detecting this early is that the symptoms are very limited in the newborn period and very difficult to detect. And this is a very large gene that has a very high rate of spontaneous mutation. So about a third of all of the children with Duchenne muscular dystrophy that I've seen have not had any family history. And so then without any family history or any reason for the families to suspect that there might be something going on in the muscles of any of the boys born into the family, it becomes much more difficult to diagnose early on. And then when the symptoms develop, they develop very subtly, I think. And we have this combination of the very gradual onset of muscle weakness superimposed on the normal development and maturing of the central nervous system and new skills that a child might have. So a child with Duchenne will gain motor skills, but they tend to do it a little bit more slowly and a little bit differently than their peers.
Sure. In one of the most recent patients I had seen, I had seen an 8-year-old who had presented, hasn't seen medical care for a few years due to the pandemic, but at that point had already shown severe progressive delay, was physically struggling to walk, was showing me himself his Gower maneuver of pulling himself up his legs. Generally, for these younger patients, for the newborns, for the babies, I mean, what are the non-motor and non-neuromuscular symptoms that clinicians such as myself should be aware of for DMD?
You know, very honestly, in the newborn period, it's very, very difficult to detect any differences. But as the children become toddlers and begin to stand and learn to walk, you can see some subtle changes. Frankly, some of the earliest changes we see are non-motor. There's an increased incidence of executive dysfunction problems, you know, with focus, organization and attention, some verbal learning disabilities, and an increased frequency of autism and autism spectrum within children who have dystrophin mutations. So I think any kind of general delay like that should, with a primary provider, raise a question about would it be appropriate to screen for a Duchenne with a CK, because that's a relatively less expensive diagnostic test that could be included as other things, you know, chromosomal microarrays and other things like that are done to try to evaluate just general problems with overall cognitive and social development. The two other things that I seen that might make a difference to primary providers is a short stature, shorter than the siblings. And then the final thing is unexplained elevation of liver enzymes. So if the ALT and AST are elevated without the GGT being elevated, sometimes that launches a very large GI workup. But in fact, if the GGT is normal, very important to remember to get a CK. There may be other specialists involved by this point in time, but even all the primary providers, you want to think of getting that CK because that tends to be quite strikingly different in toddlers and school-aged children with Duchenne. And then that leads us directly to be thinking about the dystrophin deficiencies.
Now, Filippo, your son was diagnosed with Duchenne muscular dystrophy at 3 years old. Before his diagnosis, what were the signs and symptoms that indicated he might need a referral for further investigation?
Well, I must confess, we didn't see any sign before because we were noticing a little bit of weakness, but, you know, nothing that could really worry us. Going back after we got the diagnosis, if I go back now and think about that time, I can say that probably when he was just an infant, he was probably less mobile, as you say. He used to sleep on his back, not crawling, and that was one of the things. And indeed, Luca was our first son, so we were not used to notice differences because we didn't have any compared, we couldn't compare with anyone else apart from the kids at school. So it was easier maybe for the teacher, for the people at the school to notice something when he was so young. But we couldn't notice anything. When we had the second one, Giacomo, and it was something like 17 months after Luca, we immediately realized that there was something wrong, but Luca was almost three, so it was the time to go. because Giacomo was jumping everywhere. Luca was a very quiet and reflexive boy. He used to read, to be very quiet, so we were not able to see any difference.
Clinically, yeah. Where I practice, how we work in the United States, if we see a child with any types of developmental delay, delay of their physical skills, we typically refer on to and program early intervention where they get a full evaluation. What was the initial referral pathway for you? What was that experience like?
So we started to notice, as I was telling before, that he used only one leg to climb the stairs. So this was the first thing that made us kind of, you know, weird. And then he was very suffering at night because he couldn't breathe. And so we were trying to understand the causes of this situation. So he had a very important adenoid situation. So he had to undergo tonsillectomy. And so we did all the tests and we noticed that he had 11,000 CK. And that was the first ring that sent us to the specialist. So we did a biopsy and then we moved on.
Sure. And obviously after this diagnosis, how has this impacted daily life for you?
Well, it's a kind of terrible situation because you see a well healthy boy because he doesn't have any other symptom, but you already hear to the situation that he's going to face in a few years. Because when Luca obviously had his diagnosis, it was 28 years ago, the world was a different one. Now we have a different situation, so we know we can have hopes for another 20, maybe 30, maybe 40 years. At the time, it was quite serious because we know he was risking his life when he was 14, maybe.
Sure, of course. And your experience with the whole multidisciplinary team, how has that worked for you?
Well, the multidisciplinary team, even now, even in the best center in town, is not 100% guaranteed. So we're still working to have everything smoothly going from one to another. Sometimes in an hospital, you are not able to find everyone. So you need to run and through one hospital and the other. So it's not so easy. But obviously, that would be the perfect situation.
Thank you both for Dr. Kuntz and Mr. Buccella for this interesting discussion. And thank you for our audience for listening.
Thank you for listening to this Touch podcast. You can access more content on this topic on Touch Neurology at www.touchneurology.com. Don't forget there are three other chapters in this series, so please listen in for further insights from the multidisciplinary team.